Good morning or afternoon, I guess, depending on how early you get up. So we've got the sign-in sheets up here again, and it follow the same process as before. Do it row by row. So you can go ahead and start that. My name is Joe Piccone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the new chair of Electrical and Computer Engineering. But what's more important to you is I'm the will most likely be the Senior Design 1 instructor when you all move to Senior Design 1 next semester. I'm teaching Senior Design 1. Who said yes? Someone doesn't know me, obviously. Most people say no. So I'm teaching Senior Design 1 for the first time this semester. So I'm pretty excited about that. I've taught this course for a while at my previous institution, so I'm pretty familiar with how these things go. So I've also been working closely with Dr. Shah on the development of this class this semester. There's a lot of things, as you'll see throughout the semester, we're preparing you for what you're going to be doing in Senior Design 1. So I'm pretty excited about the way this class is running this semester. So what I wanted to do today is to introduce you a little bit to the way I view the senior design process and really try to give you some good direction about what kinds of projects you should be looking for. And hopefully by the end of today's lecture, you'll have a little bit of fun and we'll have a pretty good idea of what makes a good senior design project. And as you know already, that's one of the major outcomes from this course, is that we want to make sure when you leave this course, you're on an approved project that you'll carry into Senior Design 1. And that's going to be really important this semester, so you're going to hear a lot about that. So let me begin with a simple question. What's the difference between engineering design and systems integration? And what are some examples of each of those? Now, before you answer that, recognize that a lot of the senior design projects, when they first come to me, are really more about systems integration than they are about design. And design is what we're really interested in teaching you in senior design. That's why we call it senior design. So we really need to understand, before you begin shopping around for projects, what makes a good design project. So what's the difference between engineering design and systems integration? Who wants to volunteer? I'm going to get you talking sooner or later, so talk now or you'll have to talk later.
System design is something that is brought up as a new idea, something that needs to be implemented and started from beginning, right off the drawing board.
That's your definition of engineering design?
Yes.
I wouldn't quite agree with that.
Okay, that's your viewpoint.
But I do hope at some point this semester to show you a video of an amazing machine that Rodney's built. So he actually clearly understands engineering design. But so give me an example of a systems integration project or piece of technology that really was more about systems integration than design. The iPod, very good. Why? Because you heard about that in another lecture? when they put the first iPod together, were any of the pieces unique?
Possibly some of the integrated circuits.
Possibly. They actually weren't all that unique. What about building a PC? Would you consider that systems integration or would you consider that design?
Systems integration.
Why?
Because the hard drive is already proven technology. So is the video card. The systems that are actually on the motherboard themselves, the network interface, it's already designed. All you're doing is putting it together.
Right.
The north and south chipsets are already done by Intel.
Good. So a PC, you might say, on the one hand, is systems integration. There is actually a design component to a PC, though, that involves the customer. And we'll talk about that kind of thing in a moment. So what's an example of a design project? What's an example of a project that clearly has a lot of design in it? There are lots of them all around.
The Martian lander, rovers. It was all designed for the Martian surface.
That's a good example. What about something more immediate? What about the design of a building, architecture? We have the business school was recently built. Those projects involve a lot of design because you're going to be involved in trying to match the customer's requirements to the technology and all of those kinds of things. So another example of design that I like to give are things like golf clubs. You look at a golf club, it looks very simple, but there's actually quite a lot of design that goes into the engineering of a golf club. So first let me begin with a quote from that I picked up the other day, sort of differentiating between scientists and engineers. I think these days engineers are kind of feeling perhaps a bit unappreciated in the world, but the fact is engineers really play a very important role. So a scientist seeks to understand what is, the engineer seeks to create what never was. This is a quote attributed to Theodore von Karman, who's supposedly the father of supersonic flight. Scientists sort of discover things. If you look at what's going on in high energy physics, you know, people win Nobel Prizes, but what they're really doing is just smashing atoms and trying to figure out what's inside of there. Engineers, on the other hand, change the world through the things that they build. You talk about something like an iPod and you think about the influence that kind of a device has had on the world. That requires a complex process of conceiving a product and bringing it to market in a way that meets customer needs. That thing never really existed before. It doesn't exist in nature. It's designed and built by engineers. So what we want to do in senior design is to help you understand that there is actually a scientific process for engineering design. This isn't just sitting down at the bench and twiddling around with some technology or some circuits. There's actually a very well-developed and extensive design process that goes on. And why it's important to know this is that when you go into your jobs, your first jobs, wherever you, when you graduate, you're going to be introduced to probably the other 95% of engineering that you don't really like. All the paperwork, all the presentations, all the management stuff. But all that stuff is part of the engineering process to bring a successful product to market. So what is design? Well, I thought, well, let's look up what Merriam-Webster says design is. So design is to create, fashion, execute, or construct according to plan, to conceive and plan out in the mind. So you see in this definition, there's a significant premium placed on the notion of creation and planning. As engineers, you hear a lot about the bad economy, job being outsourced and such. What kinds of jobs are being outsourced from the U.S. in when it comes to engineering? Mostly the routine manufacturing jobs. Where is the? What kinds of engineers actually make the highest salaries and really demand the best kinds of jobs? Who are the engineers that really make companies run? The design engineers. Why? No, they don't manufacture products.
They
create the products, right? And ultimately, the products are what makes the company survive, what makes the company profitable. So what I often like to stress about engineering, what you really need to get out of your education here is to learn about the creative aspects of engineering, because that's where the value added is. That's where the jobs are that you'll be hopefully finding when you graduate, and the jobs that will probably stay in well-developed countries like the U.S. for many years, because this is primarily a creative function. This is not, engineering is not about solving a homework problem, which is sort of, I think, what you think of when you go through engineering educations, because any problem that's been solved before these days is automated in some way on the computer, and there's no real need for you to solve that problem again. That wasn't the case 40 or 50 years ago, but that's certainly the case now. That the primary function of engineers today is really to create and to innovate, and that's where all the value added is. Most of the manufacturing technology is very mature, very sophisticated, but that's often outsourced to wherever you can do that the cheapest. So in my field, for example, electrical engineering, it used to be a lot of engineers would come to the field because they would talk about, well, I like to work on the bench and I like to kind of put circuits together and things like that. Today, most electrical engineers may never even see an actual circuit. They will sit in a computer terminal and design their systems in using simulation and design tools. And then when it comes time to actually build that, they just hit a button, send it off, and it's fabbed somewhere, and it comes back to you a few days later completely built. And that's, I think, you know, that's a great thing because we've automated a lot of that process. But at the same time, what you do as an engineer has really changed dramatically. So here's a definition of design from Wikipedia. And I think, you know, we as engineers don't often think about design as being in terms of architecture and such. But very clearly, design is something which spans many, many fields. And the process for which we use in design is actually somewhat universal. And that's one of the things you're going to learn this semester. But you also notice that in this definition, design is the planning that lays the basis for making of every object or system. Again, you see the use of the term planning. And that's, I think, one of the things you're really going to learn throughout the senior design sequence. Now, who does our boss say, what does our boss say about design? Well, many of you may know about ABET. That's the organization that accredits your engineering degrees. This is the way ABET actually talks about senior design. Students must be prepared for engineering practice through the curriculum culminating in a major design experience. And it talks about things like standards, realistic constraints, and takes into account things like economic, environmental, sustainability, manufacturing. So in senior design, you're going to be asked to address all of these issues, not just the issues in your narrow discipline. And again, we'll talk more about that today, and we'll spend a lot of time in Senior Design 1 on those kinds of issues. Now, in our particular senior design experience, there's a few things that I like to emphasize. The first one is that I would like the teams to be multidisciplinary. That's really one of the unique things about our program here at Temple. And I think that that's very valuable when you're trying to address all of these issues. So as you form your teams, I'd like you to reach out to the other departments and get people who have expertise in some of the areas not represented in your immediate discipline. A second thing we're going to stress is this concept of customer-driven quantitative design constraints. And we'll go through some exercises today to reinforce that concept. But this is another way in which engineering has really changed. And it's been an evolution over the last 20, 30 years. It used to be engineering was fun because you could build whatever you wanted and then you just hoped that you could sell it to the military or somebody like that. But today, everything is really driven from customer needs. And almost every product you look at is really optimized to meet customer needs. And that's really the important thing about the design process, is building something that people actually want to buy, they want to pay money for, and it serves a valuable function for them. That means, however, that you have to understand what the customer needs are, and you have to understand who the customers are, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Another big way that engineering design has changed in the last 20 or 30 years is the notion that we have to really worry about these real-world issues like energy and sustainability. I was telling a Senior Design 1 class yesterday that when I went to Japan in 1991, it was amazing to me. You would drive past these little PC stores or these little stores that sold copiers and things. And behind those stores, there would be literally a mountain of old equipment just piled up in a big pile behind the store, creating a really nice toxic waste site. And you'd see this all over Japan. And you would see this also in the U.S. to some extent as well. Of course, that kind of thing is no longer tolerated, particularly in a country like the U.S. We have to worry about what happens to these products after people are done using them, after they discard them, and hence things like recyclability are a big concern. We also have to worry about the environmental issues in the manufacturing process. You could have a really great technology today, but if that requires really toxic chemicals to do, you may not be able to do that in today's world. You maybe could get away with that 20 or 30 years ago, but in today's world, you're going to have to look really carefully at how you manufacture your product so that it's environmentally friendly. And we'll, therefore, we'll spend some time in senior design worrying about those kinds of things. Now, I think the two most hated aspects of senior design are actually this stuff, the project management and the professional communication. Professional communication, I think, you know, I hope everybody appreciates this. When you look at people who are successful in engineering, most often a large part of their success is attributable to their communication skills, not their technical skills. In today's world, that's just essential because you have to be able to communicate your ideas to people if you want people to support your ideas. Many of you in your first jobs, within your first year, are going to be asked to come up with ideas or to propose things that you will work on. And that will require making presentations to your management on what it is you think you want to do as an engineer. Your ability to articulate those ideas will have a large impact on their success or failure. Not just the technical concepts, but your ability really to convince your management that your project is worthwhile. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later today. Project management is an area that really has come a long way in engineering. In the older days, yeah, you could do projects where you had large budgets, you didn't worry about money, you didn't worry about schedules. But today, because everything's done on such short time schedules, everybody worries about project management, and you'll spend more time probably on project management than you will on the engineering job itself. That's just the way the world is. So we're going to teach you in seminar course a little bit about this, and we're actually going to take you through this process in senior design. And one of the things I always like about senior design is the students will often say, well, how do you expect me to budget time and resources for a project that I've never done before? And the reality is that's what engineering is all about. Your ability to forecast accurately cost and time on something you've never done before, that's actually one of the things that's going to distinguish you as an engineer. Because at some point you're going to ask somebody for money to support that activity, and they want to make sure that by the time you spent their money, you've actually delivered what you promised. So we're going to introduce you to a lot of this. And I know it's a little bit stressful and a little bit tough, but these are, I think, really important in terms of your long-term success as engineers. Okay, so that's enough of the boring stuff. Let's actually talk about design, real design. So what I want to do first is to take you through an example you all can relate to from a personal point of view, to see what it looks like from the customer end. So let's talk about buying a car. Has anybody bought a car recently? Nobody's bought a car recently. So from the customer point of view, and fortunately, you're all engineers, so we can actually talk about this in a little more concrete terms. How do we go about buying a car? You've all contemplated this, I'm sure.
Determine what you want first.
Determine what you want.
Research of what you want.
Okay, those are good. Research of what you want is good. We'll come back to that concept in the back there.
How much money you have.
How much money you have.
What
you're going to be using the vehicle for. Very good. And
maintenance of the car.
Want
a newer used car?
What? How? Right. A newer used often relates to cost. To cost, right? And that kind of thing. It's interesting. Nobody said things like how fast it goes, how cool it looks, how many car seats I can fit in, which is what parents often worry about.
How many cup holders?
You know, I used to joke about, well, you know, there's a whole story behind why cars have all these cool things now, like cup holders and that. And that's actually a good example of engineering design. Cars were not as ergonomic as they, in previous years, but because the demographics of the market changed quite a lot, they started to pay more attention to those things.
Gas mileage.
Gas mileage. Very good. Thank you. Somebody's thinking there. In your lifetimes, I tell you, you better really worry about gas mileage because that's becoming one of the dominant costs of ownership issues. Okay, so we're going to have to pick some of these and kind of work our way through this website because at the very bottom of this, we want to find the best car for us. So what do we want to start with?
How about an engine in performance? One, a choice?
Thank you. All right, so there's engine and performance. Fuel economy, acceleration, transmission, drive type.
Engine type.
Engine type, fuel type, number of cylinders. Number of cylinders.
I don't want any. I want electric.
Tell me about number of cylinders.
12 cylinders.
36 cylinders, right? We want the Ferrari with
Jaguar.
The... How does the number of cylinders relate to some of the things that we were just discussed in this room? Gas mileage. How do number of cylinders relate to gas mileage? All right, I'm hearing a lot of... Could you give me an equation that describes how the number of cylinders relates to gas mileage?
Displacement.
Displacement. Oh, tell me about that. That's pretty good, pretty sophisticated concept. Tell me about that.
It's the bore times the stroke times the RM.
That sounds good to me. We have an expert on cars, so he'll keep us honest here, but being an electrical engineer, that sounds good to me. I'll go with that. Is there a linear relationship between number of cylinders and gas mileage? Yeah, I guess a linear relationship. So if I told you I want a certain amount of gas mileage, would that immediately dictate the number of cylinders? Or would there be some kinds of trade-offs involved?
No, there's trade-offs involved.
Why?
Because the number of cylinders isn't going to be the same as displacement. If you have, a 4-liter six-cylinder or a 4-liter V8, you're still going to have displacement. There's a very good chance you're using a similar amount of fuel. So it's not necessarily the number of cylinders. It's more so engine size and even type. So the diesel has the same...
So I want to buy an F-350, and I've been watching the Super Bowl ads, and this thing's going to apparently carry like 2.5 tons. But I want really good gas mileage, so I'm going to put a one-cylinder engine in this thing.
It's not going to work so well.
Why isn't it going to work so well? Will I actually get optimal gas mileage with a one-cylinder in that F-350?
At idle.
Right. Well, I want to do something more than just look good sitting in my big truck on the curb there. So, we all talked about maybe we want good gas mileage, we want good price, but number of cylinders, there's this kind of complex relationship between number of cylinders and all these other factors that we're interested in, right?
Correct.
Well, that's what makes design different from what I call solving homework problems, right? With homework problems, usually, you know, you're given some problem, you're given four pieces of information, you're given an equation with five pieces of information, and your job is basically to compute the one unknown variable, right? Most homework problems ultimately become that kind of a game. And that's why engineers don't really get paid money to solve homework problems, because computers can do that today. But what is design is all about trading off these different constraints to come up with the overall best package for the customer. And as you look at all the different kinds of cars and trucks and vehicles that are out there, what is the one kind of overriding principle is that in the eyes of the designers, they've optimized each one of these for a particular segment of the market that they're trying to reach. And that's what design is all about. It's trying to deal with these very complex relationships between all these different factors and trying to come up with the overall best combination of those variables for a particular customer's application. So let's just, you know, play with this a little bit. Let's see what we should see what's under number of cylinders. So, generally speaking, what kind of a car are we looking for? We have to sort of pick some class. So we're going to go small and energy efficient, or we're going to go big and powerful?
$4 a gallon, 4 cylinders.
Okay, so 4 cylinders, very desirable. 8 cylinders, very undesirable. Okay? What else? So what's our next most important design constraint?
Fuel
economy. All right, Rodney, we're going to ask Rodney.
Fuel economy.
Anybody else? From the back over there, the back three rows there. All right, fuel economy. 65 plus. Well, that's an interesting choice. So what happens if I had chosen 8 cylinders and I choose this 65 miles per gallon, very desirable, what's going to happen when I run that design?
Division by zero.
It's going to come up with no matches, right? Because that combination is not currently feasible with technology. And again, that's another thing. So that sort of gets into what I like to call the tussle between engineers and marketers. Your marketing department is often the people who are going to determine what constraints you operate under as an engineer. And your marketing department is famous for going to customers and doing what? I wouldn't call what marketers do necessarily market research, especially if they're on commission. They're going to make promises. What kind of promise? They're going to make promises based on what? What their customers want to buy, right? So they're going to come back to you with the 65 mile per gallon 16 cylinder car. Might be a truck, actually. I don't know.
For $10,000,
right? And your job as an engineer then is to begin the very delicate negotiation with the marketing people to arrive at some set of specifications that make sense. So we're interested in 4 cylinders. What kind of gas mileage do we think we can get out of 4 cylinders?
35.
Now, if we actually selected the 65, how do you think that's going to influence the design? You're going to get a smart car, right? You're probably going to get a hybrid or electric. Okay, let's do one more so we make this pretty specific. Acceleration is a good one from an engineering point of view. Tell me about acceleration. I was a kid in the 60s when everyone wanted muscle cars, right? And they got 8 miles per gallon, but they were really fast and really big. Dodge Chargers and all those kinds of things, 440 Hemis and all this. Tell me about acceleration.
0 to 16.
What?
0 to 16.
Okay, what about it? What's it going to cost you in terms of other aspects of the design?
You might want to put like a turbo or a supercharger in it just to kick up the boost of the car.
Right, but if I just play with acceleration as an independent variable, what's going to happen to my design? It's probably going to drive the cost up, right? So acceleration is related to some of these other factors, like gas mileage. If you want a car that has really good acceleration, you may have more than likely pay for that in terms of lower gas mileage. And certainly that's an area where you see high-end automakers compete, trying to provide you with a certain gas mileage, but yet claim the best acceleration in their class. I was reading about a car, I don't remember the name of it, it's one of these really high-end cars, I think it costs like $1 million, $1.5 million, and it does like 0 to 60 in like 2 seconds, it's unbelievable, but it's, you know, it's a really, really high-end car. What about the, for years, acceleration and speed actually crossed over into some legal issues. Can you just build a car that goes an arbitrary speed? I mean, can you sell a car to regular old consumers that goes 300 miles per hour?
No.
Why? There are, at some point, some government standards. So often when these really high-end cars are built in Europe, to actually get them into the U.S., they have to go through modifications. So that sort of crosses over into legal and political issues, that sometimes your designs will be constrained by legal issues, for example, regulations and such.
I was going to say some of them aren't legal to drive on the street.
And there's this whole thing about street legal and that kind of thing. And then there's other issues like insurance, right?
How many people in here can drive stick?
Really? I'm impressed.
Was there any other thing?
I have never learned how to drive stick. It's like low tech. Automatic transmission, this is like the greatest invention. How many of you would buy a manual transmission over an automatic transmission? See? That's amazing. That's interesting. Okay, so let's select acceleration. Now, remembering that we want to get pretty decent gas mileage out of this thing, What's going to be a reasonable configuration for these parameters?
Somewhat slow.
Somewhat slow? How many of you would buy a car that was advertised as somewhat slow? So what, somewhat fast? Okay, so those are our choices, and I think if we hit click finish at this point, it should give us some option choices for cars. Any idea what's going to come up? Honda Civics always seem to come up across just about
300,000 miles.
Toyota Camry. Right? Because if you think about the set of parameters we picked, it's kind of in the middle of the operating range for cars. It's not surprising that Toyota Camry, Honda Accord, if we had gotten into issues like cargo space and seating and all that, we might then further split out these choices. So what we've discussed is really important from the point of view that once you decide on your senior design project, I'm going to ask you to come up with 10 quantitative design constraints. 10 is like the perfect number for this. 5 of those will have to be what I call technical constraints, things like acceleration and such. 5 of those will have to be what we call real-world constraints, things like size, weight, power, sustainability issues. And those 10 design constraints are going to really govern your senior design project. And at the end of the semester, the success or failure of your project will be determined in terms of those 10 design constraints. We will ask you to demonstrate that your project meets those 10 design constraints. And you'll actually do, for those of you building hardware, you'll actually do a live demonstration of that on the final presentation day at the end of second semester. And we will be sitting there with our little checklist, checking off your design constraints. Now, many of you at first pass will complain, well, I don't know how I can make these quantitative, but we've just gone through an exercise that makes it very clear that for just about any product you can imagine, there are ways to quantify these constraints numerically. And that's one of the first and I think most important parts about senior design is taking this problem and reducing it to a set of measurable design constraints so that you can then determine success or failure based on those. So I think let me go back to the lecture. So, senior design is not about creating a unique project concept, inventing a new gadget, or doing something that has never been done before. These are nice, and certainly we always love it when students create, you know, some great invention. But what I don't want you doing is sitting around as a group, spending hours trying to think about some really cool gadget or some really cool thing to do. Instead, what I want you to do is to go around and talk to all the different faculty members and find out things that they're interested in. Because it's hard at this stage of your careers to do invention. Senior design is not about invention. It's about learning the process of design. Now, what does that mean? Well, senior design is about translating customer needs into quantitative design constraints. And that is going to involve figuring out who the users are for whatever it is you're trying to do, and maybe even interviewing them to understand what's important to them about the project that you're doing. It's going to then be about optimizing your design constraints to meet these constraints, because you want ultimately high customer satisfaction. That's generally how you sell good products. It's about creating test plans early on in your project. Before you've actually built this thing, you're going to create test plans to determine whether you've met your design constraints. And these will be detailed plans where you actually describe the tests you're going to perform to prove that you meet your design constraints. And then the fun part, it's also about fabricating a prototype. And I realize that that's going to vary from discipline to discipline, but generally speaking, all of you will get your hands dirty trying to actually build something that meets your design constraints. Key elements of this class include learning how to communicate your ideas to management and the customer. So there will be a series of presentations and documents that you generate that describe your project. It will be appreciating multidisciplinary aspects of the engineering design. And we've talked, I think, a lot about that today. It will be about understanding how these practical constraints, such as cost and sustainability, influence the design process at every step. Very often in your designs, what you want to do as a technologist is limited by what you can do, either for customer reasons or for technical reasons. When you talk about designing a car, right? Designing a car would be easy if you were building a box. And if your job was to build engines, right? And you were given a box to build that engine in, that would be pretty easy. But if you've ever looked at a car, what's really amazing about cars is they have all these kind of unique and funny shapes, and they stuff technology in every nook and cranny of these cars, right? And that makes the design process much more challenging. What are some of the other ways in which these kinds of practical constraints influence your ability to design a car?
You have to have access to obviously all the filters.
You need the car. You need maintenance is a big issue with cars, right? What was one of the, when they went to these unibody cars early on? What was one of the big complaints about that? Insurance companies actually initially had great complaints about the way they, today they, this is normal design, but years ago it wasn't, cars weren't quite built that way. But when you're an insurance company, what do you worry about with automobiles?
Safety.
You worry about safety?
Total cost.
Cost of what?
Fixing.
Cost of fixing, right? So if this thing is really, really packed solid and really cool, but you have to literally disassemble the whole car to work on it, that's going to be a high cost of repair. When they first, I'm certainly dating myself here, but when they first came out with the front-wheel drive cars in the, like, America, you know, America was generally behind some of the other car manufacturers in the, I think it was the mid-80s, is that probably right, Sandeep, when the front-wheel drive started to really dominate? They used to have these pictures of mechanics on the front of magazines with the socket wrench combination they had to use to change the spark plugs. And one of the cars, I don't know if it was a Chevette or something, but it was famous because the mechanic, they used to have this big, long series of socket attachments that it would take to actually change the spark plugs. Tuning up the car, very expensive because of the difficulty with which it took to get at all the plugs. They've actually fixed a lot of that lately over time. The construction, for a while, they were building these really nicely sleek styled cars, very aerodynamic, but the minute you got hit, they pretty much had to, the repair costs were very high because to repair the body was very expensive because they couldn't only repair small chunks of it. They pretty much had to replace like the entire front or the entire back. So there were, for a while there were all these reports that even if you sustained like a 10 mile an hour crash, your car was totaled because the body would, deform in certain ways because it was a single kind of single construction. So when you're trying to build cars, one of your major constituents is not actually the direct customer, but it's going to be the insurance industry, which wants to make sure that you don't do some things that are going to run them out of business through high maintenance costs and things. What about placement of engine components? So we talked a little bit about the need to be able to access these things. There's some things you have to be able to change, like the filters and the spark plugs, without taking the in. You know, you have to have access to those things. How is that going to influence your design?
It can add an extensive cost to
to your design.
Sure, because now you're going to have to make room for removability. Or it could take more time to actually figure out to do it with the same amount of money.
Right.
So, like you were talking about in the early 80s, they just stuffed an engine in because you had to change a water pump. Who cares? Not their problem. Now, they want to have to change the water pump. So they're going to have to make a design change or figure out another way to give you an access panel to change that water pump.
Right. And water pump's actually a good example because in a lot of cars, it still seems to be hidden behind the engine, very expensive to replace. So as a design engineer, what are some of your options? If you work at Toyota, and this is somewhat of a true story, if you work at a company like Toyota versus a company like Chevrolet, not to pick on American car companies, but if you work at Toyota and you recognize that the water pump is hidden behind the engine, what's your design strategy going to be? Well, part of it's going to be company culture, and what's your company culture at Toyota going to tell you to do with that water pump?
They really didn't really get any good basic idea about where to place the water pump because it's always like with the timing belt, and that's a whole process. Every time you change the water pump, you have to change the whole timing belt.
Well, we'll get to the timing belt. That's been one of my pet peeves about cars.
Yeah, sorry.
But water pumps, what is a fundamental corporate culture, you've heard about this in the press, I'm sure you've heard about this, about Toyota's design philosophy. Toyota claims their cars in the same class as some of the American cars are designed for what kind of a life cycle?
No maintenance.
Virtually no maintenance. Toyota claims they designed their cars the last 12 years. And they said that at a time when American manufacturers were talking about 3-year replacement cycles for a lot of parts. And this is one of the ways they grab market share. Even today, they're still advertising their durability. So if you're the engineer designing that water pump, recognizing that it's going to be very hard to replace, you're going to want to choose a very good water pump that's going to last 12 years. That would be the Toyota, in a nutshell, the Toyota design strategy. Amazingly, if you were working for an American car company in the 80s, you might actually say something like, well, you know, replacing the water pump is good because that's going to generate revenue for us. So that's a feat. The fact that the water pump fails after 3 years and costs $800 to replace, that's a feature of our designs from a corporate perspective. So as engineers, you're going to have to face these kinds of things. If you look at on the inside of cars, one of the areas they've made great improvements is the way they've protected cables and the way they've socketed connections and things so that they really hold up well over a long period of time. 20 years ago, you could look at certain cars like Toyotas and see really nicely protected wiring with really solid connections, sometimes weather sealed and all that. You looked at American cars and you saw a lot of exposed wiring that wasn't very well protected from the elements. And somewhat as a result, American cars got to be known for having a lot of intermittent electrical problems, which if you've dealt with those are really nasty in cars. Because one, changing the wiring in a car is a really difficult process. And that's another example of you had car manufacturers deciding they wanted to prevent those problems during the design process versus car manufacturers saying, we want our cars to be cheap and we don't really care that they last for so long. So they didn't pay as much attention to that. So understanding how these kinds of practical constraints influence your designs is going to be really important. You as an engineer in your discipline are going to be constrained by all the other disciplines. I think when Dr. Shaw put his slide up about his design team where he was the only ME, that's a very real situation. And all those other people are going to tell you what you can and can't do in terms of your mechanical engineering part of the project. So the other concept I wanted to really raise today was this issue of how cost, performance, schedule, and risk kind of define your designs. If performance was the only issue and cost was no object, we could design really great technology, right? That's not how you can't succeed in today's world doing that. Typically, performance and cost have to be traded off, and that's a really important part of the design process. And cost has many components, development cost, life cycle cost, manufacturability, all those kinds of things. But trading off cost and performance is a big issue. Now, trading off cost and schedule is also a big issue. Initially, when you look at your senior design projects, you're going to say, well, let's do part A first, and when that's finished, we'll do part B, and when that's finished, we'll do part C, and when that's finished, we'll do part D. And you're going to add up all those parts, and guess what? The total amount of time is going to be like 4 or 5 semesters. So you're going to have to look at ways to compact your schedule by overlapping various activities. But that does generally 2 things. That raises your cost, and that raises your risk. But a primary driver in senior design is your schedule. You have to finish in 2 semesters. And you have to accomplish your task with the four persons' labor over 2 semesters. So you have to influence some of these other factors. So generally speaking, in many disciplines, people talk about cost, schedule, and performance. But risk is also very important because you don't want to have too much risk if you're a company, because if all your high-risk things fail, then you run out of business. So companies will also balance their portfolio based on risk. They'll have some high-risk projects, some low-risk projects. Most of your senior design projects should be fairly low-risk, but they will have some risk. Okay, so that's about it for today. I will see you in about 6 months or something. in senior design one. Good luck.